Welcome to Orphaned Entertainment, a podcast dedicated to public domain and abandoned media. I'm your host, Christopher, and with me as always is a person who knows how to take a sinful vacation. It's Lydia.
I was going to go for the mid-Atlantic accent, but I'm really not sure that I can.
How are you, Lydia? Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here, as always.
Well, thanks everyone for tuning in to this month's episode. Orphan Entertainment is available wherever you get your podcasts and wherever you choose to listen. If you have the option to do so, please rate and review the show. That helps get the show in front of more eyes and hopefully into more ears. And of course, if you can share the episode you're listening to on whatever social media platforms you use, that's appreciated as well. You can follow the link in the show notes to all our social media sites, as well as our YouTube channel, where you can watch many of the films we've covered here on the show. If you'd like to email us with any comments, suggestions, or feedback on this or any episode, please type or record a message and send it to orphanedentertainment@gmail.com. With that, let's listen to an Ellery Queen one-minute mystery and a promo for another podcast. And when we return, we'll see what kind of fun can be had when Sin takes a holiday.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call The Simple Slip. A well-to-do banker was murdered, and two suspects, a business associate named Waxman and a nephew, were detained for questioning. Waxman said he arrived in town after a late airplane flight and drove to the house through a driving rain. The nephew claimed Waxman burst into the house, ran to his uncle's study, and shot him. I saw him holding the smoking gun myself, he claimed. I asked to see the front hall, which was immaculate. I returned and selected the murderer, the nephew. In a moment, I'll explain why.
Have you ever wondered how much of that movie you just saw actually happened? My name is Dan Lefebvre, and I'm the host of Based on a True Story, the podcast that compares Hollywood with history. On each episode, we'll tackle a different movie or TV show that claims to be based on a true story and separate fact from fiction. So when you're ready to learn how much actually happened, search for Based on a True Story in your favorite podcast app of choice, or find it over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com.
In the case of The Simple Slip, the nephew said Waxman burst into the house and shot his uncle. Yet it had been raining heavily that night, and there was no mud or water in the hall. The nephew was lying. A simple but fatal slip.
Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Sin Takes a Holiday is a 1930 romantic comedy directed by Paul L. Stein and stars Constance Bennett, Kenneth McKenna, and Basil Rathbone. The film went into the public domain in 1958 when the claimants declined to renew the copyright in the 28th year of publication as required by the copyright laws of the time. In the film, Sylvia Brenner is a secretary for a well-to-do divorce lawyer, Gaylord Stanton. Stanton only dates married women in order to avoid any pressures of getting married himself. When his latest girlfriend, Grace, announces that she is getting a divorce, she immediately sets her sights on Stanton, expecting a marriage proposal. Seeing only one way out of having to marry Grace, Gaylord convinces Sylvia to marry him in name only. She can travel and live her life as she likes, and Gaylord can continue to do the same. Sylvia and Gaylord are married, and Sylvia takes a ship to Paris, where she meets one of Gaylord's bachelor friends, Reggie Durant. It doesn't take long before Reggie begins to fall for Sylvia, but things get really complicated as Sylvia may actually have feelings for Gaylord. Constance Bennett was a popular actress throughout the 20s and 30s. In the 1930s, she was one of the highest paid actresses in Hollywood. Frequently playing women in high society and melodramas through much of her career, she took on more comedic roles in the latter 30s and early 40s. Constance is also the eldest sister of Joan Bennett, who we watched as her most evil in 1945's Scarlet Street, and as her very lovely self in 1936's 13 Hours by Air. Constance spent some time in a convent before entering acting. She began in New York-produced silent films before meeting Samuel Goldwyn of MGM brought her to Hollywood to appear in 1925's Cytherea. She left film in 1925 when she married, but returned after her divorce in 1929, which also coincided with the advent of talking pictures. She worked briefly with MGM before moving on to RKO in 1932, where she was cast alongside actors like Clark Gable, Cary Grant, Frederick Marks, Faye Ray, and with Greta Garbo in her final film appearance in 1941's Two-Faced Woman, in which many critics of the time thought Bennett stole the film from Garbo. In the 1940s, she worked less in film but found plenty of work in radio, even hosting her own short-lived show, Constance Bennett Calls on You, from 1945 to 1946. The show featured discussions of topics in which women were interested in, from new hats to families to world events. A preview article in the trade publication Billboard said, "She'll tell about the people she meets, the places she goes, and the things she does." She toured on stage in the title role of Aunt Mamie from 1957 to 1958, and her final film appearance was filmed in 1965 for the Madam X as the blackmailing mother-in-law. And Bennett passed away in July of that same year, and the film was released the following year in 1966. Kenneth McKenna was involved in trading stocks and bonds before being discovered and cast in an off-Broadway play called At 9:45. He debuted on Broadway in 1920, and he also directed and produced plays for the Theater Guild. Once moving to Hollywood, he worked in front of, as well as behind the camera, even directing several pictures in the early 30s. He did everything from working as a story editor to being a department head at MGM. Basil Rathbone may be best known for his portrayal of Sherlock Holmes, which he did for 14 of his 70 films, as well as several times on the radio. He began his career on stage in England. He and his family moved there when he was only 3 years old after escaping his birthplace of South Africa when his father was accused by the Boers of being a spy. In the 1920s, he appeared and toured the world in many Shakespearean plays as well as others. Rathbone was once arrested in 1926 along with every other member of the cast of The Captive, a play in which the character's wife left him for another woman. Though the charges were eventually dropped, Rathbone was very angry about the censorship because he believed that the homosexuality needed to be brought into the open. Rather forward-thinking point of view for 1926.
Very, yeah.
He began his silent film career in 1921, and his first talking pictures was in 1929's The Last of Mrs. Cheney. This would also be his last role as the romantic leading man. He played Philo Vance in a 1930 adaptation of the Bishop murder case, and through many films in the 30s made a name for himself as the suave and awfully deadly villain in the number of costume dramas and swashbuckler films. David Copperfield, Captain Blood, A Tale of Two Cities, and The Adventures of Robin Hood, to name a few. He also appeared in several early horror films. He was Richard III in 1939's Tower of London, and the son of the monster's creator, Baron Wolf von Frankenstein, and Son of Frankenstein that same year. And as I said earlier, it is probably Sherlock Holmes that he is most recognized. His first appearance as the famous detective was in 1939's The Hound of the Baskervilles at 20th Century Fox. He made one more Holmes film with Fox, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, before the character was picked up by Universal, and they produced 12 more from 1942 to 1946, all starring Rathbone and co-starring Nigel Bruce as Dr. Watson. He also appeared in Sherlock Holmes' radio series from 1939 until 1946. As it often happened, playing Holmes typecast Rathbone, and he found himself tied to the character despite appearing in other film roles, which Rathbone resented, largely leaving film for a time to return to Broadway. Through the 1950s and 1960s, he continued to appear in several anthology programs on television. He appeared as a panelist on the television game show The Name's the Same in 1954, and took roles in cheap film thrillers such as The Black Sleep, Queen of Blood, and The Ghost in the Invisible Bikini, wherein a character jokes, "That guy looks like Sherlock Holmes." Also, Hillbillies on a Haunted House, which also featured Lon Chaney Jr. and John Carradine.
I've seen that. I don't know why. It might be an MST3K film.
I think I watched it as a riff tracks.
Yes, riff tracks, probably.
That's the only way I've seen it.
That sounds right.
Rathbone's last film, a low-budget horror film, was called Autopsy of a Ghost in 1968. Yeah, apparently he resented being typecast, and much like it happens, and I remember you hear stories of like Leonard Nimoy, who was really pissed that everyone called him Spock, even though he went on to do other things or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, I think he did kind of come around and accept the fact that this isn't such a bad thing, and he would make not so much appearances as Holmes or anything, but he would sort of spoof himself, or he would go on things like Carson or something like that, or talk shows of the time and be like a Sherlock Holmes like character or something like that. So I think he kind of came around on it, or at least grew to accept it.
Yeah. And he, in case it's never come up in the past, Basil Rathbone is one of my all-time favorite actors. He's up there for me with David Niven, with Danny Kaye. The only movie that I just is always Basil Rathbone to me is that you didn't mention is The Court Jester with Danny Kaye, where he plays pretty much Guy of Gisborne again,
right.
But in a ridiculous comedy, of course. But it is interesting. It's funny. Like, I've seen Captain Blood and all those swashbuckling movies, you know, in my youth a whole lot, but not as much recently. So now I'm like, now I need to go back and watch him again, because I just didn't realize that Basil Rathbone was in there. But I guarantee that he's, you know, his characters in Captain Blood and those other movies are what make the movie so great, right? He's just so good.
He is very good. I know him most from like the Sherlock Holmes and a lot of the like the early horror films that I mentioned.
Yes.
Towards the end, or the, you know, end of his career, middle of his career, when he would do some stuff for, I don't know if he actually worked with Roger Corman with some of them. I want to say he did, but he would, you know, Karloff and a few of the others were kind of in the twilight of their career, and he would appear with them. And
yeah,
things like The Ghost in Invisible Bikini. Not my favorite beach movie, but
haven't seen it, but now I'm curious.
I got on a kick and watched all the AIP beach films, because I just thought they ended up being kind of fun, and they were at first, but by the time you get to that one, it's like, yeah, not so much.
Yeah, they're more of a late night. Oh, it's fun to see them once in a while, but maybe not to binge.
Yeah, precisely. it was something too, when he came into the scene in this film, I felt like everyone else can now go home.
Well, okay, so this is the first movie I have seen him in where he plays a character that is, you could argue, is a romantic interest, even though in, you know, Robin Hood, he might be after Maid Marian. He's never considered a serious suitor. So I felt like this was a really interesting role for him, even though it's admittedly maybe a morally questionable role in the era that it was made. It is also, like, he seems serious. So not just, you know, fooling around, as opposed to Kenneth McKenna's character. And I guess at this point, I want to make sure we're through all of the trivia so that we can start talking about the film.
Yes, we can start talking about the film now. That's all I had for us.
All right. So we jump into it, and Sylvia is the secretary for, I'm going to call him by his last name. I've got Stanton in my head, Gaylord Stanton. But Sylvia is Stanton's secretary, and his treatment of her is interesting, because I don't feel like he's as dismissive as he could have been. He treats her like she's a professional. Now, he doesn't notice her as a woman, but he treats her like his secretary. He's not skeezing on her or anything like that. But he's, you know, their conversations are kept very much to the point of whatever's going on with cases, which isn't for very long because they get interrupted very, very quickly. And he's got this character that makes me laugh that she's showing up in the evening. He's just getting up. Like, he's still, I think he's in his, like, he's got his suit pants and his shirt on, but he's maybe wearing a dressing gown. I'm not quite sure. He has this real, like, upper class regency lifestyle going on, where he wouldn't dream of waking before noon, and it's probably 5 p.m. at this point. And it's just a super interesting kind of dynamic to me. His friends show up, and we get this little moment where they're all talking about, you know, the different stages of marriage that they're all in.
I want to speak to my husband at once, do you hear? Now, don't tell me he's not there, because I know...
Oh, I know what she's saying. By heart, I know it. Tell her I'm not here.
I say, or I'll come right up there.
Just a moment, please. Mr. Richards is not here.
Oh, I know very well he is, Barry.
I'm sorry, madam. Mr. Richards is not here. I've not seen him. Mrs. Richards says...
I know. Don't tell me. Can you imagine her calling me here? I told her I wasn't coming here. I told her 20 times I wasn't coming here.
Have a scene?
No. A brawl.
Well, you fellas would get married.
Well, it's the normal way to live. Finding your way out of the house at night. Everybody should get married once.
Hmm. Just to find out how really happy you can be. Single. I know, so I don't have to prove it.
You're both wrong. Get a wife such as I have.
You don't see yours once a month.
Mm, that's the point, but I'm in no danger. You are.
Oh, I don't think so.
A single man is always in danger. A clever woman could get you most any time she wants.
You definitely get the idea that both these guys are hardcore playboys.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of came across to me that Durant does not have to work at all. And
exactly. No, I guess, somehow, I don't know what he does, but yeah, he definitely has money at his disposal.
Oh, he's inherited it.
Probably.
With that voice and that accent, for sure he's inherited. He might be a younger son, but he's got land. He's got property back in England. but then, and they have a little bit of an interchange with Sylvia, which is interesting to me because they talk to her. And again, they talk to her like she's a person. They aren't treating her like in a lot of films around these times, there's this kind of casual, not exclusion, but almost like talking down to. There's a lot of men talking to women like they're, oh dear, that's okay. Just go off and buy something. Why don't you? You know, but they're asking her like, what's your opinion on this? And she...
What do you think, Miss...
Brenner.
Miss Brenner.
I'm sure it doesn't make any difference what I think.
But I would like to know.
Well, Mr. Stanton says it isn't all luck that has kept him single. I was just wondering... Who has the other half of the luck? May I wait in the library?
Oh, certainly. I'm afraid I shan't be able to work until later. I'll have your dinner served in there.
Thank you.
Being the clever working woman that she is, says, my opinion's not interesting to anybody, right? She's trying to pull basically an Elizabeth Bennet here and saying, oh, I wouldn't dream of having an opinion because it's not welcome. And excuses herself and then overhears... when Grace and some of the other women come in, and Grace is basically there at some point, she overhears Grace saying, oh yeah, basically she has hooked her previous three husbands and Stanton's not going to get away from her. Why should he? She's been successful with her previous three. And I'm skipping around just a little bit there for the sake of continuity, hopefully. but I think up until that point, we're supposed to be believing that Sylvia is in love with Stanton, or at least has a crush on him.
Yeah, they do a little bit to try to give that impression. They give her an opportunity or two to kind of have little, you know, the doe-eyed look at him. And when he finally does, Grace announces that she's getting a divorce, which is going to mean she can marry again, and she sets her sights on Stanton, and Stanton comes up with the idea, why don't you marry me? She looks genuinely excited. Do you want me to marry you? And he's like, mm-hmm. until he says, well, you know, on paper.
Yes.
Oh.
But I feel like they're trying to push this idea, but... And when the first time I watched it, I felt like, oh, good. She's like clever. This is going to be really interesting. And she very quickly is not excited about being asked to be married in name only, even if it's with a rich man, goes home to her two roommates.
Did that guy keep you late again? Not late. It's midnight.
Yes, I know, but I've been walking. Walking since 9:30.
Walking? Alone?
Yes. Trying to think.
Oh, what's the use?
None. Did a man ever try and seduce you?
Good heavens! Sylvia! What happened? Sylvia, what's happened?
Oh, don't get alarmed. Nothing's happened.
Then what are you talking about?
Something I had this morning that I've lost. My pride, my belief in myself. I knew I was no beauty, but I... Wouldn't it it be dreadful to be seduced? Well, I've discovered something infinitely worse. Finding out that nobody wants to.
How did you find out that nobody wants to?
I did.
How?
Stanton asked me to marry him.
Oh.
He's in a jam. Then he took one look at me and said I could travel alone.
Well, what's wrong with that?
If you ask me like that, what's wrong with it, I don't know.
Hello there.
Bobby, Stanton wants to marry Sylvia.
What?
Yes, it's on the level.
It isn't a pipe dream. What do you think of that? Gee, I'm glad somebody around here gets a break. Oh, Sylvia, it'll be a thrill just thinking about you. Buying clothes, getting your hair and face fixed so they look like something. And not worrying over the fact that it costs half your make.
But, Bobby,
isn't he nice? Are you in love with him? How'd it happen? Oh, say something. What's the matter?
I used to think he was awfully nice. He isn't. No, I'm not in love with him. He's even less in love with me. He just happens to need a wife.
What's the matter? Is he going to become a father?
No. He wants to marry me to keep from marrying someone else.
Oh, why can't I meet a guy like that?
He wants her to travel. Live outside of New York, I suppose.
Any strings?
I don't think so.
He's not offering you marriage, dearie. He's offering you heaven.
Yeah, I mean, she's being offered to marry a guy. She's going to get $5,000 a year, which back then is an insane amount of money. She pulls out a $5 set of pearls later, and I looked up the conversion, and it was basically $100 today.
Yes.
So $5 to $5,000, we're talking $500,000 a year, pretty much. That's a lot of money that she's being offered. And they talk her around to it.
I got a kick out of that scene. I don't want to leave that scene too early because her roommates, we only get to spend a little bit of time with them.
Mm-hmm.
Annie, I think, is the one that's in bed when she first comes in and talks. And she is definitely, I think this is Zazu Pitts.
Mm-hmm.
And she is definitely the ditzier of the three sort of thing. There's a great line from her where after... Sylvia tells her that, you know, he wants me to marry him, and they're like, oh, what's going on, and this and that, and he's like, well, no, to get him out of a jam, and Annie says, did he find out he's going to be a father?
Yeah, is he going to be a father? And there are a lot of lines in the first few minutes of this movie that are very clever and very funny, and they get completely lost.
Yeah, no one acknowledges that she says that. No one looks at her like she's crazy. Nothing. It just keeps moving. The scene just keeps going. It's like, that's supposed to be a joke about a woman getting in trouble or something like that.
She doesn't understand how it all works, which makes sense because they're all three supposed to be very unattractive girls, which is ridiculous because Constance Bennett is incredibly pretty.
Yeah,
and so
they put her in like dowdy clothes, but you can't mask how that woman looks.
No.
You could put her in a burlap sack and you could still say
her face
she's
is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they keep talking about how, oh, she could get her face done and her hair done. And I'm like, surely doesn't need to, guys. I get that, you know, we're modern people looking back 100 years, almost 100 years now, saying, oh, no, she's gorgeous. She's gorgeous. And at that time, they might have said, oh, she's so plain because she hasn't done anything with her makeup, where we're like, that's a lot of makeup. But you just miss it all. It all gets glazed over. Mm-hmm. And her response to everything that's said to her, there is very little emotional response to anything. And at first, I thought, as I was watching through it the first time at the beginning, I thought, oh, she's just kind of one of those dry sense of humor, doesn't really respond too much. Maybe she'll give kind of a sarcastic reply or ironic reply, but she's not going to, you know, go overboard. But then as the movie goes on and she then takes to ship, heads to Europe, runs into Durant, And does, again, a real clever thing where, you know, he says, would you like to dance? And she says, oh, Mr. Durant, it's so good to see you. And he says, oh, yes, I had no idea you were on this ship. And then goes and asks the steward, tell me who the woman is that I'm about to dance with. And she just maintains this extremely level to the point of flat demeanor. Mm-hmm. And the longer it goes on, and especially the longer she and Basil Rathbone are in the same scene together, the more her behavior, her acting comes across as extremely flat and a bit acting to the back row, like a bit over the top, a bit the song from White Christmas comes to my mind, the choreography song. They used to dance and now it's all doing choreography. And it's now she's not acting, she's posing. And you get a lot of the dramatic looks into the distance. She doesn't quite put the back of her hand to her forehead, but she almost does. It's almost like she's fighting not to. And as it goes on, it becomes more and more pronounced. The really funny thing to me is watching Kenneth McKenna, a couple of times I did a double take and was like, is that Douglas Fairbanks Jr.? He just reminds me of Douglas Fairbanks Jr.
I can definitely see where you could too, especially with the mustache and everything. Yeah.
And the suits they're, I mean, it's that kind of that the uniform almost of the upper class back then, but he's like bright and cheery and energetic. And early on, you think, oh, yeah, I can totally see why she would fall in love with this young, handsome, single, wealthy man who's, you know, got a bit of a, you know, he's the player. He's a playa.
A bit of a cad.
He's a cad. He's a rake. And so you understand why she likes him. But then her personality just comes across as cardboard over and over in this movie, even at the point where she's supposed to be, oh, he wants to marry me, gasp, oh my goodness, you know, she does this slow light up where her face gets bright, and then it's almost as if she's not reacting to anything. It's almost as if you've got the director on the side in a silent movie kind of, which is just only a year or two away from that, right? But saying, no, you know, off with the big loudspeaker going, you look up, you see him, you're delighted, bigger, bigger, and now you're sad, you know? And she's like, that's the kind of acting that we're seeing from her in this.
It's a little bit like the audition scene in The Nut Farm a few films ago.
Yes, it's so much like that. It's to the point where the acting on Constance Bennett's part, I feel like, feels extremely amateur in this movie. And I can't tell if it's because the directing was trying too hard to get the perfect Hollywood glow around her, or the director did a lot of overseas at directing and maybe there was a communication problem. But the problem isn't that Constance Bennett is just so bad. The problem is that she's so wooden in the company of Kenneth McKenna and Basil Rathbone, who are just lit up. They're just so natural and they're so confident. And then she's like a marionette, kind of.
she does, through a lot of the film, you get the feeling that she's bored. I think is how I would describe
it. Yes.
And so through most of the film, she seems bored. And then the moments when she's actually supposed to be a little bit more forceful.
Animated, yeah.
Or animated, it feels way out of left field. Because yes, it's like, well, where did that come from? Because literally the last scene, you were playing this very flat and just kind of going through the motions.
Yes. I agree. That's a perfect way to describe it. And she'll say things. And again, at first, I think she's just being reticent is a good word for it. At the beginning, I think, oh, she's just watching what she's saying and holding herself back because she doesn't want to appear too eager in front of this man she likes. But then she keeps doing that and continues to behave that way through pretty much everything. Anytime, and it is kind of funny, anytime that the two competing men are in the room with her, either one of them, she's like almost Eeyore. And then there's one scene a little bit later where she's playing the piano. And I'd love to know how a working girl has time to learn how to play the piano like that. But moving on. And there's a famous tenor singing with her, Italian man. And he's singing, you know, beautifully. She's playing beautifully. And she looks interested. She's like enjoying herself and listening to his music. And they're making eye contact. And it seems like, oh, yeah, I really get this. In the background, you have Basil Rathbone watching her, looking like, frankly, Colin Firth in Pride and Prejudice watching Elizabeth Bennet. That's the face he's got, is that expression. And I thought, I wonder if Colin Firth saw this and was like, I'm going to do Basil Rathbone in this movie for that. But he's like, he just looks so taken with her. And then again, as soon as they're kind of talking to each other, she's holding herself back, which makes sense in the context of her not trying. She basically is friend zoning him as hard as she can. Mm-hmm. But she also, then whenever, anytime she talks about Stanton or to Stanton or around Stanton or thinks about Stanton, she goes into this mysterious woman talking to the back of the row and making sure she's projecting. It is kind of bizarre. And it feels like, it feels like she's just trucking along, and then somebody's like, okay, now act. And she, like, doesn't know how.
Yeah, and that scene at the villa with the piano, it's a party that Durant has thrown, and there's all these people. There's, it looks like someone from the French military is there. The tenor is there. All of them are just falling over each other to spend time with her. Mm-hmm. And you're like, why?
Well, she's a little more lit up with them.
You know, that is true. She's a little bit more animated with them, and yeah, she's showing a little bit more, like she's enjoying herself or something with them. But I guess that my problem is more from the fact that we don't see any reason why everybody would be so taken with her prior to this.
Yes.
I mean, we kind of go with Durant saying, well, I always stay here, but I'm not going to. So I think you should. I got to keep it up anyway. Someone should get some use out of it. Okay, great. And then there's a party and everyone is just, oh, in love with Sylvia.
Well, we get two or three little tiny cutscenes. One where she's dancing with somebody and Durant's sitting back in the back watching with that adoring look on his face. Like he's so happy she's having a good time. And then it transitions and they're playing roulette and he asks her to play for him. She says, you're bringing me luck. And somebody else asks her to play his chips for her. Like basically you get the idea that she's out every night dancing. She's winning big at the roulette table. And I feel like there was a third. Oh, yes. They go like watch some ice skating or something like that.
Good point. Yeah.
And so we have just little tiny tidbits.
Oh, sure. The auto race. It's Durant that's taking her around, showing her all the
a good time. Yes. But we aren't really seeing. You're exactly right, though. We aren't really seeing where she's flirting with lots and lots of men. We see her with him a significant amount of the time and obviously get the idea that it's enough for their pictures to get into the papers. But then you're right. All of a sudden there, I feel like it was just something that was thrown in there to make a point.
You've never been in better voice.
I'm sure you know why. It takes two to create a love song. You helped tonight. The perfume of your hair, the warmth of your eyes, but more important still, the unseen cup that passed between us. I want to drink deeply. I want...
You should really write poetry.
I could, now.
You seem to know all the words.
Perhaps.
One can never discover you alone. Couldn't we step out for a moment and talk?
Can't we talk here?
Oh, I am not at ease here.
Are you sure I'd be at ease there?
Oh, je suis désolé.
Sylvia, dear, before I forget it, won't you come and spend July with us at Biarritz?
Well, I haven't.
I'll persuade you. I have a pleasant surprise for you, I think.
Good, thank you.
She just asked me to stay with them Barretts. I think she'll invite you, too.
She'd better, or I'll cut her heart out. Sylvia, can't we have a moment alone together tonight?
Why?
Don't ask me why.
Well, I don't suppose anyone would notice if we stepped out in the garden a moment.
Oh, sure, nobody will notice. And they look back and they're like eight men watching them. I think they really did it just for that moment, that little moment of humor.
Yes.
But it doesn't play off very well.
I just wish there was even a line in the dialogue of maybe having her wondering why, you know, all these men are you know, paying her so much attention and having Durant explain, because you're new.
See, yeah. And this is where I disagree with you a little bit, because I feel like we're supposed to believe that she is the one that's orchestrating this, that she's intentionally out there trying to attract the attention of a lot of men so that Stanton will notice. But then a little bit that same night, maybe, or a little bit later, she's talking to Durant again, and he says, he's like, oh, don't you know how I feel about you? And she says, oh, but you don't want to get married. And he says, no, I've changed almost as much as you have. And she's like, oh, have I changed? And she does the voice again.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, and, you know, the only person that could notice it would be somebody that hasn't seen you since you left New York, which is an extremely awkward, strange, very weird line that I didn't care for at all. They're trying very hard in this scene to make, like, to allude vaguely, heavy air quotes, to the idea that, oh, somebody's going to notice her now. But there's a problem with this. Obviously, we're meant to believe that she's going to go back to, and we've seen Stanton a little bit here and there with Grace being jealous that he's now seeing pictures of Sylvia and interested. We're supposed to believe he's a little bit interested in her. But the problem is, she has spent at least half the movie at this point with Durant. They have, in my opinion, much better chemistry than she has with Stanton. And Durant has been consistently interested in her, is spending time with her, and Stanton now is interested in her because he saw a picture of her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because now she's all dressed up and beautiful, where before she was, it's the whole, you know, she's all that kind of thing. Oh, not the girl in the overalls, come on.
Right? Oh, no, she doesn't have a lick of makeup on except for eyeshadow and mascara and a little bit of lip gloss. Nobody could like that.
It's the girl in the ponytail. She undoes the ponytail.
Yes!
She looks like, she's on the cover of Cover Girl. Yeah.
It's that trope, guys. You know what it is.
It is.
But the problem is that all through this, the longer they're together, the more personally, and probably I as the viewer, am convinced that Durant is actually in love with her. And so now we have her who keeps saying, I'm not in love with Stanton, even though we're supposed to believe that she really is, even though we haven't really seen anything to prove that, except for her slapping his photo off a table at one point. And we're supposed to believe that she's madly in love with Stanton for reasons. And we're supposed to believe that that Durant's not right for her because reasons. Oh, because they're not arbitrarily married for 3 hours before she got on a boat. That's why.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to believe that Stanton, who knows nothing about her except for her hours and how much he paid her, which he had to ask her that, by the way. He didn't even know how much he paid her. He is now going to become madly in love with her because she has a different hat on. And this is a problem.
Oh,
this is
very much.
This is a big problem movie for me. So she says, oh, I used to love some. Oh, Durant says, do you have a lover back in New York? And she says, no, I couldn't call him a lover, but there was somebody I was in love with. Now I have to go see. And, oh.
Yeah, Durant tells her at one point, I think it was at the party, that she's like, everyone in that room thinks we're having an affair.
Yes.
And then I don't think it was that scene, but maybe a scene or two later where he says, I'm just sorry that they're wrong.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's his way of confessing his love for her. I wish we were shacking up.
Well, yeah, that's what I would much. Say. Hey, baby.
And so, yeah, when he gets down to the point with, you know, do you have a lover, marry me, you know, divorce Stanton and marry me, and do you have a lover? Well, she doesn't admit that it's Stanton that she's even talking about to him. Yeah, she decides she has to go back to New York and face this man one more time to see if she still loves him.
But I don't think that's what it is. The way that it's played off, he says the only person that couldn't notice how much you've changed is somebody that hasn't seen you since you left New York. And she gets this light up expression like, oh my gosh, maybe now is the time to go back and see Stanton and see if he's noticed how different I am, which is exactly how the rest of the movie plays out. She's like, did you notice I'm different? Did you notice I'm different? Hey, I'm a little bit different. And he's like, I saw a picture of you. And you're like, what is going on with these people? What?
Yes, he saw a picture and suddenly gets interested. Grace saw the picture and decided that, well, she's obviously having an affair with Durant, all from a photo of them at a racing event.
I would believe that you could argue that Grace knows Durant, and so she's like, for him to spend this much money with a girl, or time with a girl, I'm sorry, they're shacking up. I could buy that. They don't say that, and they should say that, but maybe they feel like they can't say that because it's 1930.
Yeah, that's true, because these are just a whole group of friends, I guess, people that know each other. So, yeah, it's a very strange collection of people because all of them are married. None of them to each other.
Yes. And they're all definitely
of them dating.
Yes. Yeah. And we're treated to a very quick little peck on the lips from Stanton to Grace after she announces she's getting divorced. And she is like, it's the I'm leaving the house for work in the morning peck. Like, this is a couple who are comfortable giving each other that kind of kissing. Mm. And so, yeah, it's. There's definitely some, I would argue there's probably hanky-panky going on, even if they're not saying it is. It seems obvious.
Well, because there's even a moment towards the end of the film when Grace finds out that Sylvia has come back and, you know, threw all her stuff out of the bedroom that was left there just in case someone might happen to come by.
Yes.
Of course.
Well, and this is a weird 1930ism. It's a powder room. So Technically it's a room for the ladies to go powder their noses in, but it's done up with a big round bed.
It's
with
got
satin
a big,
sheets.
It's got a bed that is the only reason that bed is made the way that it is to have sex in.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So, there's stuff going on for sure. And so yes.
I think among the entire group, you know, there are like three couples in this group.
Mm.
Like I said, all of them married, none of them to each other.
Yeah.
I think they are all involved with each other.
It's very Regency England. Ironically, it really is. There's a whole lot going on. And so, again, so now we're supposed to believe, so Sylvia comes back to New York, and we're supposed to believe that Stanton is now that he's seeing her in person, he's like, yep, definitely in love with this woman. But he doesn't say that at any point. He says, hey, now that you're back, you want to.
Yeah.
Ooh. And she's like, oh, but you have to be in love with me first. And he's like, eh, we're already married. And then I guess they all his friends are there so that he can prove to them that he really has a wife. And she's supposed to pretend she's in love with him. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Yeah, all to like turn Grace off of and make Grace mad enough to finally leave him alone.
Yeah, so then they start kissing in a mirror, Sylvia and Stanton. And you're supposed to believe, I love that scene. I love in quotes for me, because he says, oh, look in the mirror. And she looks over and all six of the other people are standing there almost with their mouths open, just staring.
I think Grace actually is agape. I think she actually does have her mouth open.
As if, in a mirror, you can't tell when the other people turn and look at you in the mirror. It's not a one-way mirror, guys. It's a mirror, okay?
Everyone can see, yes.
Yeah. So this movie falls apart so fast the second that Sylvia goes back to New York. Not that it was very well constructed to begin with, but this is a case of they forgot to screw and glue and it's just wobbly as heck. You don't want to let your kids in the same room with this thing. It is not secure. So, you know, this is a rom-com. We all know how it ends for reasons, because that's how rom-coms are supposed to end.
And everyone's fine with it. Durant has spent the entire film following her around like a lost puppy dog.
Yeah.
Trying to convince her that he does indeed love her. And you definitely get that impression that that is true from him. He is willing to change his entire lifestyle. He has 100%. Been a playboy. He is like, in the beginning of the film, he's like, marriage is stupid. You don't do it. Just enjoy life and don't get tied down. And now he's like, no, I want you to be my wife. He's willing to make a huge change in his life for this woman. And then in the end, he just decides, after waiting around for an hour while Sylvia and Stanton are in the powder room talking, he finally decides, well, I guess they're in love with each other and I'm out of it. See ya.
Yeah, he is not Hugh Grant in Bridget Jones here. He is not like pretending to be in love, but really, Bridge, he just needs just one more night together. This is not who he's playing. He's Colin Firth in freaking Pride and Prejudice, watching her at the piano like, oh, I just want to marry you right now. And then at the end, he just says, well, yeah, I guess a woman alone on her honeymoon is the most attractive girl in the world.
Right. Yeah. His party line to the butler is, oh, don't bother them about dinner, but they'll probably need a hearty breakfast. Ha ha. And leaves.
I have my hand on my forehead. I am face palming because, yes, that's the reaction. And if I had spent probably it's not quite a year yet, because they say it hasn't, the 1 year isn't up yet, but it's been months and months, 6 months, 9 months, probably. Mm-hmm. If I had spent that long whining and dining and trying desperately to get somebody to fall in love with me, I'm not the night that she gets back to her husband, who I know she's just a wife of convenience for. Like, this is not like he doesn't know. He's known since like the boat that she's just doing this for Stanton just to keep him from having to marry Grace. I certainly wouldn't be magnanimous about it. I probably would be kicking the bedroom door in. This is why I'm not in 1930s movies, guys.
And I think I would be warning her that, like, look, you know what kind of person Stanton is.
He's a playboy.
He is going to get bored of you a week from now.
100%. 110%. A week is maybe generous.
Yeah, he's not going to give up the lifestyle that he's enjoyed all these years.
Yeah, no. Yeah, give it. Next week, he's back in bed with Grace. And he's probably keeping Sylvia on the side. But, you know, distracting her by, go buy yourself another fur coat.
Well, he'll wait till Grace remarries. And then he'll start dating her again.
Yeah, and probably have a couple of other girls on the side. So this movie has problems.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like we kind of raced through it, not really intentionally, but we definitely, I guess maybe we didn't get as fast through it as I was feeling like. It felt like it's been about 20 minutes. It's been a little bit more than that. But there are some real problems for me in this movie, starting with and maybe hinging on the fact that through this whole thing, Constance Bennett feels, you said she looks bored. I think she's just, yeah, completely lackluster, not engaged, and then impossibly very poorly directed. I really came out of this movie feeling like she's just a horrible actor, but maybe that's not fair. Maybe it should be, she's a horrible actor with this director. Maybe it should be.
Yeah.
I feel like this movie, I would love this movie. There's some really good dialogue in it. There's, the end of it is a little problematic, but I feel like if you had, even a Paulette Goddard, who's great to watch, by the way, I'm not knocking her at all. If you had, I can think of a half a dozen people whose names I can't think of right this second who would have been great in her role. And it just feels like there's nothing to draw you to this woman. You don't really believe she's in love with Stanton. You believe she's infatuated with him, maybe. At the end of the movie, you believe he has seen a picture of a girl he thinks is hot and therefore wants to get her into bed. You don't believe that he's fallen in love with her. Genuinely, you don't believe Grace is in love with him, but you do believe that Grace's motives are consistent. Mm-hmm. Like, she from the beginning wants a rich husband and she'd like to have a different one now, please. You know, at Durant, you the whole time believe, yes, if he isn't genuinely in love with Sylvia, he's giving such a good impression of it that he is the greatest actor in this, you know, imaginary universe. So the only person that 100% fails for me and had opportunities to be engaging. You kind of mentioned it when her friend says, you know, oh, is he going to have a baby or is he going to be a father? You know, she would have had she could have literally reacted with any facial expression and you would have had more empathy for her. From the very beginning, you're waiting to like her. Like, you really are waiting to engage with her and like her. And as it goes and goes and goes, it feels like she's a cardboard cutout. You almost could literally replace her with a cardboard cutout and notice no difference at all in this movie. And there are so many actors in this era, her sister being one of them, who, if they had been a little bit more natural cadence, any natural cadence at all, any engagement, any kind of spark, this could have been an entertaining and fun and engaging movie, but you're just like constantly being asked to believe the absolutely unbelievable.
No, I think that nails it right there. Is the script and the story is relying on you to believe what they're telling you, but they're not going to show it, really.
Yes.
And, yeah, there's moments, like you said, you're right. In the end, even, I don't feel like she loves Stanton. The way she's acting, she's suddenly acting all kind of haughty and rather, I mean, it's between her and Grace. The script might as well just been, row!
Yeah, yeah.
Just hisses and
cat sounds, yeah.
Cat sounds between the two. And everything. And so even when there's moments when it's just her and Stanton, you don't feel like there's nothing there.
No.
There's nothing between them. There's no chemistry between them at all. Not mm-hmm. between the actors, not between the characters.
No.
So the ending, it makes the ending wholly unsatisfying because you're like, she is not ending up with the right person.
Absolutely. Yeah. Through the middle part of this movie, you are rooting for Durant to win.
Yes.
He seems like he would actually be good for her, where Stanton very clearly is not going to be, no matter what the scriptwriters are trying to tell us. And I think this could have been played in a way that you believe it. I think there could have been a lot of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, side glances, sly smiles that convinced you that Sylvia and Stanton really are perfect for each other. But, you know, from the very first meeting they have, he walks in, accepts a paper from her, reads it, goes, no, and hands it back. And he doesn't, like, you know, read it and then kind of look at her and kind of be like, oh, what's she wearing today? Oh, no, 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 back to work. That would have added a whole lot to this movie. We would have been like, oh, he's attracted to her, but she's his secretary, so she's off limits. You know, you would have had some reason to believe that he might like her at some point. You don't get her staunchly saying, I know he's a playboy, but I really believe there's something in him that people are overlooking. You even, again, with looks, there's any, I think this movie, it's not perfect and it is not, it's not going to be in its current iteration, in its current script, but I think you could make it work. And again, I don't know whether they just cast the wrong woman as the main character, because I don't think that McKenna and Rathbone are miscast. I think they both are very good in their roles. I think that there's nothing directing Stanton to show that he's interested in Sylvia. There are there is opportunity after opportunity to do that. Even when they get married and the reverend does this cute little kind of wave of his hands, like bowing his hands toward each other. He doesn't say you may kiss the bride. He's just like, and, you know, and keys. He doesn't say it, but then he kind of turns away and she puts her head up for Stanton to kiss her. And he looks at her like surprised. And then he totally does this, might as well shrug and kisses her and then turns away and is like, okay, hold on. And it's like, there could have been anything there. There could have been a moment where he kissed her and then was like, ooh, and then was like, oh no, wait, don't need that right now. Okay, cool. Thanks, preacher. But we didn't get any of that. He could have put his hand on her arm in the car and you could have had a lingering look. Literally, give me one lingering look and I will buy it. I'm a sucker for this stuff.
They could have spent a little bit more time after their wedding where they have to, because she has to, they have to hire a person to replace her as secretary.
Yes.
She's going to stay on and teach them what they need to know and everything. You could have spent that time doing that exactly what you were just saying, where they actually have some interactions and with him kind of realizing, hey, she's not bad.
Yeah. Yes.
There might be something here. Yeah. Give us something that would give you some impression that he might actually be kind of coming around on.
Yes.
Well, wait a minute. She's actually a really great person.
Yeah.
Now she's not working for me.
Yes. And that would have been such a good opportunity then to reinforce it and him go, oh, wow, she's really great, which is all the more reason to make her go to Paris. Like that would have been, there it is, right?
Yes.
There's that moment where he goes, if she's in town with me, I might start falling first, so I better get her out of town. We should have written this movie, darn it.
Right. And then, you know, and then when he sees the photo of the two of Durant and her in the paper, you know, have him, instead of just looking at it with a little bit of like amusement.
Va, va, voom.
Maybe a little bit of jealousy.
Yes. A little bit of, oh, she's spending time with Durant. She spent a lot of time with Durant, huh? Maybe I should start thinking about a ticket to Paris. No, I don't want to get myself involved in that, but maybe. But instead we get, oh yeah, she's hanging out with another guy, cool.
Yeah. One photo at an auto race doesn't mean equal an affair.
Yeah, again, maybe it's because he reminds me too much of Douglas Fairbanks Jr., so maybe I'm being unfair, maybe I'm unfairly in favor of him, but I do feel like this is a director issue. The more we talk about it, and I feel like even a bad director can't ruin Basil Rathbone. And this is pretty early for him.
Yeah, and I said that right from the start. As soon as Rathbone walks onto the set, he's immediately heads and tails above everybody else.
Yeah, he's lovely.
In the room.
Yeah, he is. I'm drooling a little bit. Give me a sec. I gotta wipe this stuff up. He's incredible. He really is. Oh. Yeah, and it's really funny. I've always watching Robin Hood when I was a kid, and Robin Hood is one of my dad's favorite movies. Robin Hood's okay. Errol Flynn's pretty snazzy. I like him, but I always thought that Basil Rathbone was like the guy, right? I was like, why don't I marry him like him? He's like, hey, you know, I'm 8-year-old Lydia or 12-year-old Lydia watching this going,
It's the way he carries himself. He is always so sure of himself. That's not the word. Confident. He's always projects confidence in everything, in all his roles. It's just he walks in, he's doing his role, and he's confident. He's bolt upright and straight. He has got complete control of everything that is going on, and that is a bit attractive.
Yeah. Even when he's clearly head over heels for Sylvia in this, he's not like unsure. He's not like, oh, but he's like, well, I really shouldn't say it, but the truth is I wish that we were having an affair. And every woman in the room goes, every woman attracted to men in the room goes, okay, sure. Wait, I'm not supposed to, but could I get away with it? everything you just said and double it. I think I agree. So yeah, it is it is really, really, really fun seeing him in a role where you believe that he's really in love with the woman. And I think you can make an argument for Robin Hood, too, where he really likes Maid Marian. But in this one, you just, I feel like you're just convinced that they really should be together. He really would be good for her. And I'm disappointed that it doesn't work out that way. Cause frankly, I think Stanton and Grace deserve each other.
Definitely. And that, in that group of friends and everything, they all deserve each other.
Yes. Yeah. And you can make the argument, you can easily believe that Durant just never met a good woman before. Mm-hmm. And when he does, he just falls for her. And I would love that to be this movie. I would love that to have been this movie. Maybe I'll write it.
Well, I think we've probably come to the time where we should put a rating on it.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's going to come as any surprises that it's not going to be high. It is not the worst film that we have seen by far.
It's not.
But I will not give this any more than a 2.
Fair enough. Going into it, I think through about halfway through it, I really thought it was going to be a 4 for me. There was enough going on. The first time I watched it, there was enough going on that I thought, oh, this is going to be good. And I had moments where I laughed out loud, and mm-hmm. I thought this is going to be good. And then it just wasn't. And so I feel like the director, I feel like the script isn't the strongest one we've ever seen, but it's also not the worst one we've ever seen. And I feel like this is most likely a director failure. I really desperately wanted to make a comment about The Room. It's not that bad. It's not that bad, but we all know the scene, you know, I did not hit her. And there are some Wiseau moments in this movie where she's like dramatically sad and then, oh, suddenly happy and then dramatically sad again. And we're like, what just happened? And yeah, I'm torn between giving it a 2 and a 1. Which is weird for me to go lower than you on a rom-com. I know that. But there are layers upon layers of problems with this movie. So I have to give it a 2 because Basil Rathbone and I think Kenneth McKenna are both decent in this movie. I think they're both act reasonably well. I think Rita LeRoy's Grace is phenomenal. She is spot on with her character. She is exactly as awful as she's supposed to be. I think for me, the big, big fail in it is the main character, and I don't know if it's her or the director, so I won't give it more than a 2 for sure. It's a borderline 1 for me, but...
All right, no, fair enough.
Can I give it 1.5? I can't give a Basil Rathbone movie 1.5. Okay, 2 stars, 2 of those for me.
Well, right. I justified the 2 because, as you said, there are moments, there are lines, there are parts of this film that are immensely enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. But movie would be a great stage play.
Yeah, but the parts don't necessarily equal a whole.
Yeah.
So I've kind of given it the 2 because there are those moments. It's not completely unwatchable. It's just in the end, you'll go,
That was awful.
That wasn't very good.
Yes. I want to like her in this. I just can't.
Yeah. I like her voice.
Yes.
I could see where she could play some good roles with that kind of that raspy voice of hers and everything. And apparently she became very well known for just being one of the most well-dressed actresses on the screen.
She has a phenomenal figure for the 30s. I mean, she could wear anything.
I could definitely see where she would be fun to watch in another film. But it's just not this film.
Yeah.
So, yes, there's little bits and pieces throughout the film that I liked well enough that I can't say, no, it's terrible, never watch it.
Right.
So that's where I could justify the 2.
Yeah, and I do genuinely think the script is decent. I really think that it's like we've mentioned twice now, the little interchange between her and her roommates, there is a lot of potential for some really good comedy in there. It just isn't, it's almost like, we had another movie we watched where we thought, that the director maybe just didn't speak English as a first language, so didn't understand where the beats should go. And I feel like this is like that too, where the director didn't understand the comedy in the dialogue, but there is a lot of comedy in this dialogue, and it's, and there's some clever stuff too. Her overhearing the conversations that she overhears early on, that's not necessarily clever, the trope of her listening through the keyhole, but you very much understand what's going on with this group very quickly. And they do a very good job of showcasing that. So I think the script is strong. The costuming, man, if you want some inspiration for some 1930s, for some gangster era dresses, for some, you know, late flapper, early, you know, pre-war stuff, this is a movie to watch for those. There's some clothes.
The gowns that the women wear are pretty outstanding.
Incredible. But
you talk about the script, and there, again, that's just one of the few moments, one of the few things in this film that stand out is occasionally the script. And there's the scene when Sylvia goes into Gaylord's office, and for some reason he's got a photo of himself on his desk.
I didn't even think about that, but that's red flag number one, isn't it?
Yeah, and she smacks it off just before the butler comes in, and he sees it on the ground, and she's it fell off. Yes, ma'am. And
yep.
Later, it didn't fall off. I hit it. Yes, ma'am. I'll tend to it.
I'll take care of it, madam. Yeah. No, there is a strong script in here. The costume is well done. I was just scrolling through. The cinematography is good in this. I feel like they did a good job. There are a couple of, I'd say, creative shots. The overhead view of the ice skaters is interesting. It's not very clear what's going on until you know what it is.
They try to do some nice transitions where you see like the roulette wheel spinning, and then it fades to be the ice skaters
the
spinning
champagne
on the ice.
Spinning in the bucket. Yeah, and they do
that sort of stuff.
So the cinematographer is good. It, like, again, like as you go through it, just over and over, it feels like all the pieces are there except for the chemistry between the main couple and the directing. And I think those are all very, very tightly linked.
So there's all the pieces are there, but it's to a different puzzle.
Yeah. Yep. I've got a round outside edge. Where's the round outside edge? This is a rectangular puzzle, guys. There shouldn't be a round outside edge. Yeah. No, that's about right. So two Othels for us on this one. If you guys have a different opinion, we'd love to hear it. If you're convinced this is the best movie ever made, we want to know if this rivals Casablanca. Please tell us why. We'd love to hear about it. Also, if you had a different take on Kenneth McKenna, and you don't think he, you know, reminds you of Douglas Fairbanks Jr., let us know that.
Absolutely. OrphanedEntertainment@gmail.com is where you can send your thoughts and to us. Or just, you know, throw a comment on the when the episode posts in the Discord channel or at any of our social media sites. Lydia, as always, even when the film isn't all that great, it's a blast to talk about with you.
I agree. The feeling is mutual always, Christopher.
But that will do it for this month. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We will talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.